This is Packer and Durham on ACCN and Sirius XM Channel 371.
Bottom of the hour, Danny Cannell stops by, and we will visit with the former Florida State quarterback and Sirius XM Morning Show co-host. We'll do that. And Justin Fuente, in case you missed it, from ACC kickoff coming up. Dallin, Sam Howell got all but 32 votes for ACC Player of the Year. 114 of 146 in the preseason poll. Here's the way it looked. De'Aaron King got 11. Brian Brzee, 8. DJU got 6. Jerkovic, Flowers, Jahmyr Gibbs got a couple behind Sam Howell. It begged the question. We ran this yesterday, and I want to share this with you. If Sam Howell is the ACC Player of the Year at season's end, it'll be the first time in 41 years that a North Carolina player has won Player of the Year in the ACC. You got to go back to Lawrence Taylor to find Carolina's last ACC Player of the Year.
Yeah, man, it's a coveted award. I do think the voting would have been much tighter if De'Aaron King did not tear his ACL last time we saw him play. I think if he's comes in fully healthy, it might be a tighter vote. Howell probably still wins, but I think that is interesting given King gets back all these offensive weapons, his line. Obviously, Sam Howell lost some of his weapons, more prominent weapons. So, I mean, it's going to be a fantastic year. And, man, the quarterbacks are deep in this conference, probably led by Sam.
Well, I tell you, the fact he's the preseason player of the year is one thing. It also brings to mind, when's the last time your school had the player of the year? And we know how it's gone. Trevor Lawrence, Travis Etienne, they've kind of run the league here the last couple of 3 years with Etienne winning back-to-back and Lawrence, of course, winning it last year. Lamar Jackson went back-to-back and winning it for Louisville. It's interesting. Here's Lawrence. He was the preseason pick for player of the year and won it. So good for him. And he had a phenomenal, phenomenal junior season at Tigertown.
Yeah, so I can't wait to see what he does in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, and again, number one pick reported yesterday. Number one pick signed and ready to go. $24 million of his 36 is guaranteed. It's a pretty good gig, right? Lamar Jackson went back-to-back in the ACC. And rightly so. I mean, this started off as an unknown, and it became a show with Lamar Jackson down.
Yeah, and the thing that's, I guess, really good for Louisville, particularly Lamar Jackson, is now everybody remembers him for what he's done in the NFL as an MVP. And that was the question. The guy almost fell out of the first round. They wanted to slight what he accomplished at Louisville, didn't think it would translate. So he's kind of helped usher in the change of the changing of the guard of how NFL offenses are run and quarterbacks that can succeed. Obviously, we saw Robert Griffin start to do it a little bit, and you saw a flash of different people, but Lamar was he's had the most success and over the longest period of time. It hasn't been a huge period of time, but they've now built this franchise around him, and I think nobody's questioning that he can continue to have success going forward. Obviously, it all started at Louisville as he dominated and kind of burst onto that scene with the Heisman campaign.
Yeah. All right, so that takes us back to 2016 because Jackson won back-to-back years. Now we're going to go down a list of schools and the last time you had a player win Player of the Year. James Conner of Pittsburgh was 2014, and James Conner delivered the goods now. I mean, this guy here, exactly what you would think. Running behind a big offensive line and just throttling people.
And his story, Wes, is what makes it real cool. Obviously, his battle with cancer, to fight that, to win that, to then get drafted and stay in the hometown team, the Steelers, and have a really good couple years there. Obviously, battled some injuries, had some different things, and their offensive line fell apart. But he had some really good years through that. And that's his legacy in that town. And me being from Pittsburgh, I mean, people were amped. Everybody was amped when they drafted him and the kind of guy he is. And again, the career he had, people absolutely love James Conner and what he's represented for Pittsburgh as a college athlete and as a pro.
All right. Florida State's last ACC Player of the Year was 8 years ago. It was Jameis Winston on his way to the Heisman Trophy. And Winston and the Seminoles also won the national championship. There's Nick O'Leary on the back end of a touchdown pass. And here is that laser to Kelvin Benjamin on the start of a big night at Clemson for the Seminoles that night for sure. So there's Jameis Winston. Now we're going to dive even further back. We got to go back a decade at Virginia Tech. And when you talk about Virginia Tech's last ACC Player of the Year, David Wilson was exploding. Now, we talk about Jahmyr Gibbs coming into this year. David Wilson was explosive in the run game. He was also explosive in special teams. And to me, that's why he helped capture Player of the Year honors that year. And the Hokies, by the way, as you might suspect, were pretty good too. So David Wilson, by the way, who ended up playing in the NFL as well.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't have the full list in front of me. I'm interested to find out when we're going to get to a defensive player. Because you mentioned LT 41 years ago. There are others in the mix in between. I just want to know when we're going to get there because the game has changed. Offense dominates the game if we're going to get to a defender anytime soon.
All right. Well, I'll tell you when we're going to get to a defender. The school's out of the league. The last ACC defensive player to win Player of the Year was E.J. Henderson of Maryland in 2001. Yeah. That's the last defensive player to be ACC Player of the Year. All right, let's go next. 2008, Georgia Tech's last Player of the Year was not Calvin Johnson. It was Jonathan Dwyer, the running back out of Paul Johnson's spread option. I mean, and this guy came in as a sophomore and just blasted off. This is a Thursday night against Miami, by the way. And he's still running.
Roddy, did we see Roddy in the backfield? Was the player of the year in the mix there? Where was Roddy?
You know what? We may have to go back to the video. I think I saw 20 orbit one time on one of Dwyer's carries. You know, Roddy goes back to the huddle and says, hey, look, you know, fake the dive. Let's run the option.
Exactly.
So Dwyer was 2008. 2007 is Boston College's last ACC Player of the Year. Matt Ryan. Now, the Eagles potentially have a dark horse Player of the Year candidate in Phil Jurkovec. But here's number 12 from Charter Hall slinging it. And Ryan, of course, took the Eagles to the ACC championship game, Dallin.
You mentioned Jurkovec. You said dark horse. Could he be the first? Would you give a percentage chance that he actually equals what Ryan accomplished, you know, a decade and a half ago?
Ooh-wee. I think they're going to throw it enough. And they've got guys. See, the other thing, too, about BC, everybody talks about Zay Flowers, but it was interesting to listen to Phil Jurkovec last week talk about Kobe White returning, transfer from Ohio State, who never really emerged last year. They lost Hunter Long, the tight end, but that offensive line is so good. You got to believe they're going to be able to throw the football. I expect Jurkovec to put up some big numbers. And to be honest with you, if they're successful, 8, 9, 10 wins perhaps for Boston College, one might think that he would be in the talk for ACC Player of the Year if that happens. Here's one that may surprise people. Wake Forest won the ACC Championship in 2006, but did not have the Player of the Year that season. Instead, they had the year Player of the Year before. Chris Barclay, the running back of the Deacons, led the league in rushing, dotted an All-America team here or there. Just hard to tackle for Jim Grobe was Chris Barclay. Last time Wake Forest had a Player of the Year.
I love when we get to SD video. I love when we're in SD video. Now we're in that zone, baby. Let's go.
Yeah. Well, get ready because here comes a bunch of standard definition video. 2002 for a guy that just retired from the NFL last spring. Matt Schaub of Virginia is the Cavaliers' last ACC Player of the Year. 2002 for Schaub. Oh, young guy, Yeah, that's the picture's the old guy. Here's the young guy throwing tight throwing touchdown passes for Al Groh.
To Heath Miller.
There's Heath Miller. Heath Miller, a former Steeler.
Yeah.
I knew the Steeler guy would step up.
There we go.
All right. Next on the list, NC State's last player of the year. Another guy that just retired. Phillip Rivers is the Wolfpack's last player of the year. The sidearm slingshot. Jericho Cotchery, the touchdown catch.
Hmm. Also former Steeler. That's all my job here is to point out former Steelers, but he had a bigger career other places. But he did pretty good stuff for us. Jericho.
Former Steelers, nice. All right.
There you go.
Got two left here, Dallin. 1994. Duke had a remarkable year with Fred Goldsmith in his first season as their head coach. And the player of the year that year in the ACC was a running back named Robert Baldwin. Look at the shoulder pads.
Yeah, man. And, like, those are the jerseys that are almost like they have the little holes in it, it looked like, too. Like, we're getting to, like, 80s time where they had, like, remember, like, Mike Rozier and the U? They had, like the jerseys that had, like, little, I don't know, like, perforations. It was totally different material
the mesh.
You're dealing with.
Yeah, the mesh.
Mesh, thank you. There's the word.
You're right.
I can't speak.
Yeah. All right, now, Dallin, here we go. 41 years ago, North Carolina's last player of the year. We ran this video yesterday, and I thought Roddy was going to run for his life. Here he is, friends, long before the Giants. Just watch this. Just watch this in your screen.
Good Lord.
I mean, I'm not going to say anything,
dude,
Dallin.
Man. Yeah. Look, he's ridiculous. And for those people watching this, this is the second time through on this play. I could watch it over and over again. The people watching this, our audience, you definitely played Tecmo Bowl. This dude used to block field goals in Tecmo Bowl. He was the most disruptive guy in a video game ever, which like set his like lure up for people of my age that didn't see him play in college, but you start to play video games at 7, 8, 9 in the late 80s. And he was an alien out there. It was him and Bo Jackson were like the greatest people I'd ever seen in a video game. And then in real life, you're like, oh, that makes sense. It's pretty wild.
Yeah. All right, here's the question. Last schools to have player of the year, we showed you the list. Does a running back, is a player of the year at the end of the year, we talked about Sam Howell, De'Aaron King, Phil Jurkovec. At the end of the year, is a quarterback the player of the year, Dallin? Or is it I'll give you the field or a quarterback for player of the year. Which way you go?
Because of who's voting and how our society works, I'm taking the quarterback. Now, I know ETN busted that up a couple years ago, back-to-back years. But the quarterbacks, A, are deep. There's a lot of – I mean, what if NC State has an unbelievable year and Leary's healthy the whole time? He sneaks in the conversation. Right. I mean, there are really high-level quarterbacks up and down this conference compared to the country. It's the best in the country in terms of a full conference, in my opinion. So you have a lot of options
Absolutely.
To pick from. You have that. I think that's how it ends up. I'll take the quarterback over the field all day. And you know what? I might be able to throw some shekels on that. I might take a look.
The Packer and Durham Podcast. Here's Mark Packer and Wes Durham.
Packer Durham on a Wednesday continues Power Hour. Danny Cannell coming up in about 10 minutes or so. Look forward to the visit there. Justin Fuente was on our set last week on Wednesday at the ACC kickoff in Charlotte, visiting with Jordan Cornette and group, and started out the visit pretty simple. And I think Virginia Tech fans might be as anxious as anybody else, and it sounds like the head coach is. Just the environment of having fans back in Lane Stadium this fall.
They don't come to the game to sit on their hands and be entertained. They come to actively help our kids win the game. And it's more than a game to them, too. And our fans have been deprived of the fellowship that comes with home games in Lane Stadium. And I just think it's got a chance to be a wonderful celebration this year of people getting back together and doing what they've done for years and what they've enjoyed doing and The fellowship and camaraderie that comes with that within the Hokie Nation is pretty special.
Evac, before you jump in there, just want to let everybody know that game on October 9th exclusively carried on ACC Network when you host Notre Dame.
That's right. We get to talk about it. Coach, when you're starting your season with a big dog, I like to call it, there's some teams that start, you know, some cupcake-type games. You're going against one of the best potential offenses in the country. Is there a difference preparation-wise? Is there a difference sense of urgency when you're playing a team like North Carolina who is going to have such a great offense?
I love it, personally. I'm even happier that we get to do it at home. Like, we knew when the ACC Network came about, there'd be more teams opening up with ACC games. And we've done that, which is just the first time we got to do it at home. And so I think it helps in our preparation. There's another level of urgency that comes with that, knowing what it is coming out of the gate. And you get a chance to compare your preparation model. And knowing that you're going to be tested right out of the gate, you don't get to dip your toe in the water. You got to hit the ground running in the first week of the season.
Coach David Hale, an ESPN colleague of ours, also a writer, ranked every position group in the ACC from 1 to 14. When he got to wide receivers and targets, he ranked your group as number one in the conference in terms of receiving core. I imagine you agree with him. Can you tell me why?
Well, we've got a lot of guys coming back. I mean, we've got some experience. And we have a really versatile tight end that I don't know if he was included in that ranking.
He was.
He's as good as they come.
That's right.
And, what we've tried to do is we've got to get our chemistry down. Like, and I kind of giggled with the guys a minute ago because heading into this summer, which is more player-led, that was the word between the quarterbacks, mainly Braxton, and the wideouts. We got to get some chemistry. We got to get our chemistry down. We got to be able to throw the ball on time in great locations. We got to understand body language and leverage and those sorts of things. And the first couple questions for those guys up there was about chemistry, which I thought was pretty cool. We all kind of snickered. But
did you set that up that way, Coach?
No, yeah, I didn't. Right. I didn't have anything to do.
You're slipping 20s,
yeah,
everybody.
I didn't have anything to do. But I'm really excited about the experience we've got back. And we've got some good young guys, too, that we don't have to force into playing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think sometimes young players fall into that trap where they are good players, but they're forced into playing before they're ready. And we've got a chance to play with some guys that I think have some real talent, some guys that haven't played much but have been in the program. Jaden Pate's been in the program for now 3 years and hasn't played yet. Mm-hmm. Some guys that maybe people don't know that I'm excited to put out there.
Yeah, you talk about big stone gap, James Mitchell, and just how effective he can be, the things that he can do for your team. It's been very special, fun, as a former tight end turned offensive lineman with wishes I could go on a jet sweep. let's talk about the guy throwing him the ball and the consistency that you need to have at that position. What can we expect to see from Braxton now going into year two as a starter, with your program? What kind of things has he been working on to get better?
Well, I feel really good about Braxton's ability to throw the football. Mm-hmm. I really do. His understanding of defenses, his ability to push the ball down the field. I felt as good about that as I have since I've been here at Virginia Tech in terms of our ability to throw the ball. We've got it. That doesn't mean we're just going to throw it 60 times a game, but if we can run the ball and be efficient, I think it's going to lead us to having opportunities to push the ball down the field in an efficient manner, and that's what's got me pretty excited.
Coach, you're in the Grand Ballroom here at the Westin in Charlotte. We heard you several times there say you cannot create an identity without a foundation. You alluded to that here talking with me and Eric McLean. Take me through what that foundation looks like that ultimately gets you to what identity that you foresee for this program this year.
Well, I mean, we were well on our way, and we are well on our way to having an understanding of what it takes to play at a high level each week. That's the difficult part. Anybody can get up for one game. It's mm-hmm. it's being able to create that level of intensity and urgency week to week, and also being talented enough to carry you through some of those downturns. But we make no bones about it. We're about rolling our sleeves up and getting to work. You know, from the lunch pail to the hard hat to hard, smart, and tough to what we're about. But those are just words if you don't embrace that part of it. And what I've seen from our football team is a willingness to embrace, what it's going to take to give ourselves a chance to have a special season.
We've gone several minutes here without mentioning name, image, and likeness, Coach. And it plays such a big role in your job now and a hat that you have to wear as you engage with your athletes. How is that showing face? I also heard you say something interesting that it can be a detriment. It can be a pitfall potentially. Can you elaborate on some of that for us?
Well, I think there's very few people that say that it's all good or all bad. If you really look at it, if you really live in the life and trying to figure it out, there's a lot of things of it that I think are really positive, but I think it's a cautionary tale. I think we got to be careful with our young people. I was really proud of James Mitchell's answer. You know, James Mitchell's focused on football and graduation right now, and I want to make sure we're not just grabbing the short-term game, but we've got our eyes on the long-term game of what we're here for, which is get an education and train and play football along the way. And if we're good enough to go on to play in the NFL, that's wonderful. But this never leaves you, okay? You know, endorsing a product and getting a little bit of money is one thing, but your education never leaves you. And I don't want us to lose sight as coaches, as players on the long-term game. But along the way, we can still have some fun and do some good things. And we're uniquely positioned. I love how we're positioned. 250,000 alumni. We are, you know, the number one sports brand in the state of Virginia. We have a real opportunity for our alumni, for private businesses to reach out and help our kids in a legal way. Now, we also have an opportunity for young people, if they're serious entrepreneurs that have legitimate business aspirations, to go ahead and not have to wait until they're done playing, but go ahead and engage in that now. Those are all positive things, but like anything, it's like sugar. I like sugar and I like pizza, but too much of both is not good for you. And we just got to make sure we take things the right way.
That is Justin Fuente from Charlotte last week at the ACC kickoff, and great stuff with the Virginia Tech head coach with Emac and Jordan.
Packer and Durham. This is the Packer and Durham podcast.
Packer and Durham on the Wednesday ride. Dallin Cuspin, good enough to spend the 3 hours with us. And great to welcome Danny Cannell back to the program. And DC, always good to get Mr. Cannell's thoughts on things, as they say. But Danny, let's start with the Florida State quarterback position. I remember when you were there, QBs used to have to wait 2 or 3 years to get some run. Guess that's not the case anymore, is it?
No, not at all, Wes. That's what I remember, too. That was part of the recruiting pitch that they sold me was, you know what, you're going to wait, you're going to redshirt, maybe get 2 years to start, but man, how the landscape has changed. But you're right. I think there's a ton of optimism in Tallahassee around Mike Norvell and what he's building. And that's always my message to Florida State fans is it's a work in progress. It is nowhere close to finished yet. And I'm trying to kind of temper expectations because with all this optimism comes an expectation as, oh, Florida State's going to be back to where they were in the 90s or 2000s or even 2013 with their national championship. And in reality, the roster isn't anywhere close to that. But they'll be better than they have been the last couple of years, which is what I keep telling Florida State fans to hold on. Let's build a foundation, and then you can start building something special in 2, 3, 4 years. But we've got to give this roster and this coaching staff a chance.
Danny, obviously this year is exciting for the Noles. You just mentioned you got to give them some time, but there are some pieces there. It could be a good year for them. I want to take this little big picture, though, first. I haven't got a chance to talk to you in a while, so I have to ask you this. You're a great player. You're a great analyst. But maybe what you do better than anything else is you troll the SEC at an unbelievable level. Nobody does it quite like you do. So with the news that Oklahoma and Texas are going to join the SEC, what is your reaction to that news and what that means for more broadly college sports?
Well, Dallin, the reason we haven't talked is because you're too big time. Like, you're the face of ESPN, so I don't get any more texts. I don't get any more calls. But it is good to catch up with you. But this news that blew everyone away. I mean, this was such a bombshell and such an unheard of piece of news that we don't get in today's environment. Typically, there are whispers and rumblings that start to develop and it takes time. This one dropped out of the air with no one having any clue. Mm. Even the best, most insightful reporters in the game, people with deep insight, had no clue this was going to happen. Even when the news came out, because of the nature, everyone was like, no, this can't be real. And now as we find out it is going to be real, then it comes the reality of what this means. And I think this is the biggest shift, the biggest game changer in college football in its history. Like, and maybe go back to the 1920s, 1930s, or the 1984 case where the money came in and started to flow in. But aside from those, this can't be – it's huge. It's ginormous when you think about what it means for college football. Now, me, I don't know why I've been pegged as an anti-SEC guy. I have at times been critical of the conference and tried to say, well, hold on a second. They're really good, but they're not that much better than the ACC. They're not that much better than the Big Ten. With this addition, with Oklahoma and Texas, you have created a super conference, so much so that there is a balance, an imbalance of power where the SEC becomes that much stronger. Hmm. And in a playoff scenario, whether it's a 4-team or a 12-team scenario, which has been proposed, they deserve more than one team in the playoff, and maybe two, maybe three, maybe even four, with the type of quality they're bringing in. So that presents some challenges for the rest of college football, which to me is exciting. It's unknown. It would be scary, for instance, if I was a member of the Big 12 right now. But this is just the beginning of the future of college football.
And Danny, it does take on the business aspect that, you know, we've all talked about for about 20 years now, that, you know, we, as I like to joke with friends of mine, the days of letter jackets and homecoming dances are long gone. But that being said, the product on the field, and in this league in particular, and we'll pivot from that to this, this league is showcasing quarterbacks now for the first time in 6 years. The QB depth in this league is immense. I mean, you've probably got Sam Howell, the preseason player of the year, as a Heisman Trophy candidate. But you could have two, three, maybe even four other guys emerge here. How valuable is it to this league to have that position be the marquee spot this fall in particular?
It's huge, Wes. And players will still wear their Letterman's jackets. They'll just have a logo on them that they get paid, you know, a few $1,000 to have it on there. So we'll still have some of those things that will happen, but they're just going to be paid, right? But I think you make an outstanding point. And yeah, that's what the ACC should be selling, is their quarterback play. Sam Howell is the best quarterback in the country. He's got 68 touchdowns through 2 years. Trevor Lawrence had 66 through 2 years, and look how he viewed him. He was a surefire number one pick. He was the face of college football. Because Sam Howell doesn't play at Clemson or Alabama or Ohio State, I think that hurts his profile somewhat, but I think we can appreciate that he is the most accomplished quarterback in college football to date. Now, there might be other more talented quarterbacks, but North Carolina has a great one, and Mack Brown truly appreciates that. DJ Uiagalelei at Clemson could be a Heisman, you know, winner that comes out of nowhere with the talent that he's surrounded by. Derek King, if he's back healthy from his ACL, could be one of the most electric players in the country. So you've got several players in this conference that have massive profiles already that the ACC needs to sell, needs to build on. And the great news is, it's the most important position of the game. Like, I might be biased, but and this is the way the game has evolved with the way offenses work, relying on quarterbacks both with their arm and their legs. This is the most important position in the game. So if you have stability there, and not only stability, but actual playmakers, that could instantly raise up the level of your team. And if you look at the teams historically that have struggled, Florida State's a great example. The unknown, the uncertainty, the revolving door at quarterback is a big problem why they've struggled. And that goes for any program around the country.
Danny, the ACC is going to sell it. You just hope the rest of the country buys it a little bit, because perception can become reality. And hopefully people tune in and see some of these guys, whether it's Devin Leary. Obviously, Sam Howell's going to have a bigger profile than De'Ara King. But some of the guys that they may not know coming in, hopefully they know as the season goes on. But let's talk about Florida State, because you just mentioned the uncertainty. There still is some there. I mean, Mackenzie Milton's coming in from UCF. We haven't seen him play since, you know, having that horrible leg injury after great years at UCF. Jordan Travis, a different type of quarterback. If you're Mike Norvell and Kenny Dillingham, the second-year OC, how do you approach this? What do you think this battle will play out?
So I'm torn on this one because I am a firm believer that if you have two quarterbacks, you have none, right? Look at the history of college football. Maybe the Chris Leak, Tim Tebow, Florida Gator team that won a national championship had a little bit of a revolving door at quarterback, but that usually doesn't play out well. Players on that roster need to know who is our leader, who is our guy, who's going to have the ball in their hands in the fourth quarter with the game on the line. That being said, I do think you have two outstanding options to choose from in Jordan Travis, who has way more experience, more knowledge of the system than Mackenzie Milton. But Mackenzie Milton has, you know, what he did at UCF when they won the national championship, or at least claimed it, was really, really impressive. He was one of the best quarterbacks in the country. I thought he was a baby Baker Mayfield-esque type of player, but we all don't know how is he going to be coming back from that horrific leg injury. I would not be surprised against Notre Dame if you see both quarterbacks play, but I would hope that Mike Norvell by week three or week four has selected a quarterback that they can stick with and remain in that position through the course of the season. Because if both are playing, it makes me suspect of just how stable that position is. They've got to find a guy to be the leader for this team.
All right, a couple of questions here to wrap. I'm going to give you one. I'm going to give you one here, and it's fill in the blank. You ready?
Okay.
Notre Dame at Florida State is the biggest game in Florida State football history since.
I'm supposed to say one game and say it quick, but I'm struggling with it because I think it's nuanced. I think it's a massive game. But I don't think, Wes, it's a must-win game. I just think Florida State has to look competitive because I'll give you one. It's the biggest game since Florida State played Virginia Tech, Willie Taggart's first game of his tenure. And that was a disaster. It was ugly, and they lost at home. They had no offense. But that left an impression with the Florida State fan base that never went away. Florida State has to be competitive in this game.
Here's the last question.
Quick follow up on that, real quick. If they really struggle in this game, and you mentioned Willie Taggart's first game, and that kind of left that impression. This is the first game in the second season for Norvell. Is it risk him losing this program a little bit, and they start a possible downward spiral if they get blown out?
No, I don't think so. I think he's got enough leeway, and he's got enough of a pass. Last year was the worst case scenario for Mike Norvell, taking over a program that was a mess. Then having COVID, not getting to talk to his team in person as a collective until this spring. Like, that was a really long time. So he's been dealt a tough hand. I think within the locker room, you would still get buy-in. I think it would take, you know, multiple bad games for him to lose the locker room. But I do worry about the fan base. Fan bases are fickle. Florida State isn't different than any other. But I just worry about keeping the momentum going. And if you lose that game ugly, which I don't think happens, I think you risk losing a fan base, and that's why I'll be preaching patience to the Florida State fan base, just like I have for the past 4 or 5 years, which is getting frustrating, but I do think we're building a foundation of something special.
Yeah, it's definitely the long game for the Seminoles. Danny, here in the final minute, I know you posted this on social media. You got to spend some time with Coach Bowden, I guess it was in June or so. We all got the news last week. It's just deflating. It's heartbreaking in many ways, but the man means so much to so many people, not his former players, but I mean, it seems like he's connected throughout the line of college football across this country.
Yeah. Coach Bowden's a special man. And I was with him about a month ago. I was in Tallahassee, got to sit down with him for about an hour, and it was awesome. We talked about faith. We talked about our families, and we talked about football in that order because that was how he lived his life, with his priorities set up that way. And I think that's what makes him unique. So many football coaches are so obsessed with winning, and they treat their players like pawns. Coach Bowden cared about his players, both on and off the field. And I don't know if we'll ever see another coach that impacts players eternally the way that Coach Bowden did. I mean, he really cared about his players, and that's why I love him. And you won't find anybody say a bad thing about him, and that's hard to find in today's world because he treated everyone, whether it was the equipment manager to the starting quarterback to the Heisman Trophy winner, it didn't matter. He treated everyone with love and respect, and he's adored, and he should be. and his legacy will live on for all of college football history.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's incredibly well said. Hey, appreciate the time. Danny Cannell, SiriusXM, the first team in the morning, CBS Sports, on the CBS Sports HQ as well. Be well, DK. Thanks, bud.
Great catching up with you guys. Wes, Dallin, have a great day.
Here's Mark Packer and Wes Durham.
Thanks to Dallin Cuff for man in the chair today. Appreciate you, my man, for doing this. Good to see you, first of all, and to see the massive book collection. Yeah. All right, a couple of things here to close out with. Kara Lawson coaches the women's U.S. 3-on-3 team to a gold medal. That's good, right? That's a win. That's a USA basketball win, correct?
You think? Well, it's a I wouldn't say it's a USA basketball win. It's a USA 3v3. It's a USA gold medal. It's another gold medal for Kara Lawson, who was played on and won a gold medal as a player and now as a coach. That is awesome. But USA basketball, I would say, is reserved for the men's and women's 5-on-5 teams in the traditional sense. The women look great. The men, despite winning by 68 against Iran, have some work left to do.
All right. By the way, grab your microphone here because I think it has slipped off the beaten path.
All right. We're back in business. We're back in business almost. Should I show some nipple here right now? What are we going to do here?
No. No, we shouldn't do that at all. No, we shouldn't. Okay. Leads me to the next question. You said you've watched a lot of the Olympics. You said you've watched a lot of Olympics. What's your favorite sport to watch at the Olympics?
Well, we haven't got there yet. I love the track. I love track and field because it is the most pure form of athleticism in terms of the fact that everybody can play. There's no barrier to entry. Am I faster than you? Full stop. So I love that event. I love that series of events, particularly the sprints, more what I'm into. I like the hurdles as well. Love the swimming as well. Similar thing, obviously. It's different, the barrier of entry, but it's still, you know, just about your speed and pacing and technique falls more into that maybe. Handball's the event that's probably that people don't realize that I think is like fun to watch. Americans have never been good at it. It's one of the few things we've never meddled in. It's just entertaining. It's like a mix of like hockey and basketball and lacrosse and soccer. Don't really understand all the rules, but it's athletic and it's fun and it's a team game. But I think that's the cool thing about the Olympics. You can flip around and kind of explore. That's the hard part with the time difference is a lot of times people will be exploring through the course of the day and flipping the dial or whatever and going from channel to channel. You're not really doing that because you're asleep. At night, they're kind of more games that are built into our TV schedule in prime time that people are tuning into or in the morning. And of course, last but not least, I love watching the soccer on both sides, but the women's team in particular. From the U.S. and the men didn't qualify, but the U.S. women's national team—they're moving forward to the medal to the quarterfinals. Interesting to see what they can do too.
All right, here's the other question. I'm with you on the team handball, by the way. I think team handball is about a pretty cool sport. It's got a lot of basket. It's got a lot of basketball. It's got a little bit of lacrosse in it. It's got some soccer in it. I mean, from a passing standpoint, even a little bit of field hockey too. Quite frankly. All right, here's the second question. What would be the Olympic sport that you could make the podium in?
Isn't it obvious? None. Otherwise, I'd probably be trying to do it. I could joke around and say dressage.
Come on.
How about dressage? You put me on a horse from the age of like 3. Maybe I can make it move in weird ways. I don't know. Maybe I could do that. Hey, I got a quick story. I got to do a good quick story for you. So we were swimmers growing up as well as basketball players. My dad was adamant he wanted us to swim. So long story short, I swam and like state level and was good within the state of Pennsylvania, but just didn't want to do it. My oldest brother, who's 8 years older than me, was nationally ranked. He was like top 5 in the country in the 100 breasts and the 200 breasts.
Wow. Okay.
And he used to beat this guy all the time, this guy that won the 96 gold medal. So my brother, though, at 15 years old, he said he didn't want to do it anymore. He hated the training. It's brutal morning and night. You're staring at that black line. It's hard. So he went and played. He was always a basketball player too, but he invested more time in that. He was really good in our little township. He went to be a Division III basketball player, scored 2,000 points there. Had a great career, but as a D3 basketball player. I'm watching the 96 Atlanta games with my dad, sitting there on the couch. The dude that won the gold is the guy he used to be his rival and beat him all the time. I've never seen my dad more upset. Just goes, your brother could have won a gold medal. just puts down the paper and walks out of the room. Like it just left. Just ejected. But he was just because he couldn't wrap his head around it. Why would you quit doing this thing that you are elite at? One of the best people in the country, which makes you one of the best people in the world, given what U.S. swimming is, to be a Division III basketball player. Had an awesome career. Loved that dude. But my dad was a little despondent that day watching the 96 games. So he could have made the podium, not me.
I don't know your dad. I would just love to see the visual of him dropping the paper going, your brother could have won a gold medal, and get up and walk out of the room. That would have been priceless.
And now let's be real here. I cleaned it up a little. He didn't use a lot of colorful language. There was a colorful word tossed in there. That one, like he could not understand it, and just, I'm gonna walk out of here. I'll leave you do whatever you want. He had to go outside and compose himself.
That is tremendous. That is tremendous. I got to tell you, I don't know that I could, I don't know if I could do anything Olympic at the, I just don't know. I don't know. Dressage, hey, nice call on the horses, by the way. That was
there is no chance.
Hey. There's no chance. Don't hit it. Don't hit it far enough. Can't make enough putts. Don't hit it nearly far enough for those guys. Actually, golf starts today. And, yeah, Matt Kuchar medaled last time for the United States on the men's side. I am actually very interested in watching the golf play out. Of course, Bryson DeChambeau had to withdraw for COVID. So did John Rahm, for that matter. But you got Colin Morikawa over there, who just won the Open Championship. You got Justin Thomas for the United States. It's going to be interesting to watch and see kind of how all this plays out in terms of golf and the Olympics. I was glad they brought softball back down, even though the U.S. won the silver against Japan. I'm still glad we got to see softball back in the Olympics. I thought that was good.
I wish they would keep it, because I think our country has learned, man, softball is a fun, made-for-TV sport. The ratings were great for the Women's College World Series.
Yep.
It's not just a U.S.-dominated sport globally. That's been proven now, not once but twice. I mean, U.S. didn't win the last time it was in it either. So I think it's a sport that is a lot of fun that Americans love, that the world is starting to get behind. That's not going to be a next time's program in Paris. Hopefully it'll be back in L.A. in 2028.
Tune into Packer and Durham weekday mornings from 7 to 10 Eastern for the best conversations about everything from the ACC. Find it on the ACC Network, SiriusXM Channel 371, and streaming on the ESPN app.